Hey everybody, welcome back to 10% True. Just before you get stuck into this episode, I wanted to let you know that in 2024, I'm going to be republishing my book, Red Eagles, America's Secret MiGs. That's the story of the 4477th Test and Evaluation Squadron and the program Constant Peg that exposed American fighter air crew to secretly acquired and operated MiGs in the Nevada desert in the 1970s and 1980s. The book's been out of print for a while. It goes for crazy prices online, but I'll be republishing as a softback exclusively through my website, 10percenttrue.com. If you're thinking about supporting the channel, you'd like to buy the book for yourself or even as a gift, please do go and place a pre-order. I'll put a link in the description. All pre-orders are going to be 25% off, and I'll make sure I personally inscribe and sign your copy for you. Anyway, I'll let you get back on with enjoying this episode. Take care. Bones, welcome to 10% True. Thanks for joining us on the channel.
Oh, it's my pleasure, old chap. Yes, thank you very much. And I'm having my my tea this morning, and this is in honor of my friends in the UK. And I don't know if you can see it, but that's the 29 Fighter Squadron crest.
Very nice.
On the mug there. And that was the Tornado Squadron that I was on in the UK. And I don't know if you've seen this, but there was a great video that came out at the beginning of the pandemic, and it was an English gentleman who was sitting on his couch drinking a beer, and he hears a Zoom meeting call go off in the background. He goes, "Oh, time for the meeting." So he jumps off the couch, he pulls on a pre-made suit that's got the jacket and tie already built in, as Velcro up the back, sits down, pours his beer into a very fine china teacup, and he starts drinking with his pinky out. But this has actually got tea in it, so
that's
don't worry.
That's real tea. Okay, we'll take your word for it. And I'm drinking my tea out of a cup with cats on it. So
okay, I just want to do a contents check there, just make sure there's no foam on the top. Okay, fair enough.
So you've already told us you were on 29 Squadron flying the Tornado. So yeah. Just for the audience at home, then I'm going to ask you to give a quick introduction on your career and what you did. But you are obviously Canadian, you are on the channel. We're probably going to split this into two, maybe more calls, interviews. We'll see how things go. But you're going to talk about your experience as a fighter pilot flying for the Royal Canadian Air Force and on exchange with the Royal Air Force here in the UK. Yeah. With that said then, Bones, give us a quick intro then. What did your career look like?
Oh, can of worms. But first of all, I'm actually wearing a green flying suit, and this was the flying suit that I wore into combat on my last tour of combat. And the interesting part of it is that it's actually an American flying suit. It's not a Canadian flying suit. So when we deployed to Italy, we went there about 9 months prior to hostilities breaking out in Kosovo. So we were there in the summer of 98, and we had blue flying suits. So I was the, on the advance party, I was the, what we call the OPI, the officer of primary interest for the deployment, not the squadron commander, but the guy who took care of it. And there was a team, well, various teams from our upper headquarters who were there as well, getting things spun up for the deployment of the jets. And so I'm talking to the logistics officer, and I said, you might have noticed that we're all wearing blue flying suits. I said, what's the plan here? Like, if we do have to eject, because airplanes were getting shot down over Bosnia too, before the war started. I said, are we supposed to go and find a blueberry bush to hide in, or what is it? And she goes, oh, I never thought of that. So she scurried over to the American side of the base and bought a whole bunch of American flying suits off them. And fortunately, they had enough stocks, to equip us. So we all got U.S. flying suits. And then I think it took, that was 2 years before I retired from the Canadian Air Force. And by the time I retired, they still didn't have Canadian green flying suits.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, it was, and that's one, that's a funny story, but there were very serious stories of things that we totally screwed up on. So that's the downside of the Canadian Air Force. But anyway, I'll get back. So I was actually born in England. My father, I'm 100% genetically British. So both my parents were British, My father served in the British Army in the Royal Engineers during World War II. He ended up in the Far East in Malaya, now known as Malaysia. And when they demobbed him, I think it was 1946, they asked him where he wanted to go. So they said, do you want to go back to the UK where his mother was, or we can send you to any of the colonies? So he could have gone to New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, Canada. And his mother told him it was very rough still in the UK in the post-war years. They still had rationing. There weren't enough jobs for all the people that were coming back. So he decided to go to Canada, even though he didn't really know anybody in Canada anymore. So he settled in Canada. And then in 1958, as part of his ongoing education, he went back to the UK to Ipswich in Suffolk for a technical course. And he had married my mother about 4 years prior. So they had me when I was in England. So I was actually born in England. I came back to Canada when I was a baby. I was 1 year old. So I grew up as a Canadian in Canada. I was always interested in airplanes, but it was never sort of my primary focus. I guess, like many people, I thought, well, I really don't have much of a chance of, making a career of it, because I hadn't been through air cadets, and I hadn't done any flying whatsoever, even gliders or whatever. So I thought, okay, well, there's no way I could do that. But I was a passionate skier, and I had gone skiing out in the west of Canada, and we took a day to go helicopter skiing. So I just thought this was unbelievable, that you could fly in a helicopter, lock yourself on the top of a mountain, and then go skiing down. So I thought, oh, I've got to do this. So that was the real motivator to get me into flying. So I had been traveling in the UK. I think I was about 18 at the time, and because I had my UK citizenship, I actually applied for the RAF when I was in the UK. So I went through Biggin Hill, and that's where they used to do the aircrew selections, in Biggin Hill. And I knew about that from, the famous Battle of Britain movie. So I thought that was pretty great. And so I went through the first day of the application procedure, and at the end of the first day, they either clear you off to go to the mess and drink beer with your buddies, or they ask you to come to the officer commanding's office. So I was in the office with about probably six or seven other candidates waiting to be called into the OC's office. And we looked around, and three quarters of us had beards, and we all sort of went, yeah, maybe we should have shaved the beard off before we came in here. So that was the bye-bye interview with the OC. But I went back to Canada, and then I applied for the Canadian Air Force, and I shaved my beard off this time. And the first day of the selection process, there's a lot of written tests, and you do this quasi simulator, which is, I think it was based on a 1950s Link simulator. It really was hokey stuff. But the written tests, I sat down and I started laughing, and they were verbatim, word for word, the written tests from the RAF, like every single word in the right order. And I think they had been the same since the World War II. And I don't know if you're familiar with it's called the British Commonwealth Air Training Plan. So this was a big training plan to train, British and Commonwealth air crew, but in Canada, instead of being in a war environment. Yeah. So it was a huge, huge process. So I think they probably just took the written exams from that, and now I'm doing it in 1980s. It was hilarious. So anyway, I managed to fool them, and they engaged me as a pilot. I went through all the pilot training. We do well. First, we do the basic officer training, and that's Army, Navy, and Air Force. We're all mixed in together, and then we split off. So I had to wait. When I finished the basic officer training, I had to wait a couple of months before my flying training would start. So I went out to the East Coast to a base called Shearwater, which is near Halifax. And I just did odd jobs around there, waiting for my flying training to start. At this point, I was aiming towards flying helicopters, and they had quite a few helicopters there. They had the Sea King helicopters that embark on the ships, and then they had Twin Hueys for general purpose and search and rescue. So I was able to fly in both of those. They had the Tracker, which is a maritime patrol aircraft with great big radial piston engines, which was great fun. But they also had the T-33, the jet trainer from the 1950s. So I managed to get a ride in this T-33,
Did you?
and I'm telling this young buck pilot, and I said, "Yeah." I said, "I really look forward to flying in this thing, but I really want to fly helicopters." And he looked at me like, "What?" So he took me up in this T-33, and we're doing aerobatics and formation flying and pulling G. And I went, "Yeah, you're right. This is what I want to do." So that's how I ended up steering towards fighters. So we go through flying training, and we start out by about 3 months on the a Beechcraft Musketeer, which is piston engine, civilian powered aircraft. And then we went on to the Tudor, which is the jet aircraft, which is still used by the snowbirds. And they were built in the 1960s, so these things are very, very old. But the Tudor was a great airplane. We get our wings on that, and then we proceed up to Cold Lake for the fighter lead-in training, which is done on the F5. And from there, at the time, we had three different operational fighter aircraft back in the early 1980s, and that was the F5, which was used operationally, the F104, and the F101, the Voodoo. So the 101 was used for air defense, the 104 was ground attack in Germany, and the F5 was multi-purpose, primarily closer support for the army. But by the time I got to the fighter lead-in training portion, the 104, I just missed the last 104 course by one course. So if I'd been there a course earlier, I could have gone on the 104, which is based in Baden in Germany. The Voodoo had already closed, and the F-18 had not opened up yet. So I knew I was going to fly the F5. So I started on the F5 in Bagotville in Quebec. And prior to that point, all our training had been done on the prairies, which is the flatlands in Canada. Bagotville is up in central Quebec. So it's about probably 500 kilometers north of Montreal. So it's still very much central. It's not considered northern Canada, but it's central. But the terrain is quite spectacular. They have beautiful mountains and fjords and lakes and stuff. So after spending 3 years on in the prairies, it was a huge breath of fresh air to come into that region and to be able to fly there, because we did predominantly low level flying. The other interesting thing about Bagotville is the women were absolutely beautiful. So I spent 2 years in Bagotville, but I met my future wife just before I had to leave. So we ended up getting married. And then the other thing about Bagotville was the drivers were terrible. So when I first got there, they said, you'll either end up in a car crash or married at the end of your tour. And it's like, well, that's not great. That's not really what I had planned. But I guess it's better than a car crash. So, so I did my first tour on the F5. And, of course, your first operational aircraft is always going to have a special place in your heart. So, and I didn't know anything else, so I thought this thing is fantastic. We went all over the place. We weren't really under the eye of headquarters, so we had an enormous amount of flexibility on what we did, where we went, and that kind of stuff. Because the F-18s were already being implemented, so they'd sort of forgotten about the F-5, which is perfect. So our primary role was actually to support the army. So the airplane was bought to be a close air support airplane to support the army. And it was probably the worst airframe that you could possibly choose to do that role. It had no fuel. The wings are too small. It couldn't maneuver very well. It had no survivability. So it was a political decision to buy it, but it was a lot of fun. So we would roar around all over the place. We did a lot of air combat, even though, it wasn't a very capable aircraft in air combat. But I don't know. Did you get the picture that I sent you of the air refueling and the
Yeah, I
formation of the
did. Yeah,
F-5s? And
with the
yeah,
F4s.
so if you could flash that up, I'll build a bit on that. But we also went to northern Norway, and this is in the height of the Cold War, in the mid 1980s. So we would deploy to an airfield called Andøya, which is above the Arctic Circle. I think it's probably about 67 degrees north, something like that. And we would fly out of there. We would regularly see Soviet airplanes coming down the Norwegian coast. And we were usually there as part of a big NATO exercise. So, you know, there were Army, Navy, air assets all over the place from various countries. And of course, while there would be Russian fishing boats, but they would have, you know, 30 or 40 large antennae on these boats. So they were obviously spy boats. So, you know, you very much knew that you were close to the action there. And, you know, some of the exercises were fairly realistic. And this is when the doubt started creeping in and thinking, well, you know, if we actually go to war with the Soviets, do they really expect me to do this in the F-5? And we didn't even have a radar warning receiver in that thing.
Wow.
You know, so if you were lit up by a radar, you wouldn't even know. Well, I guess it's probably a good thing. You know, you don't die tensed up, but it was just ridiculous. Yeah. And we had no navigation. You know, the only navigation thing we had was attacking, but that doesn't work at low level. So it was purely, you know, watching the map and flying off heading and timing and outdoor features. So preparing the maps was a huge ordeal. You know, you had to glue strips of maps together so that you didn't, you know, obscure your whole cockpit. And, you know, you had to make sure the headings and the speeds and everything were correct. So it was usually about an hour to an hour and a half process before you went flying to get this all organized. And our squadron commander at the time, he was a great guy, rest in peace, unfortunately, but very funny. But you know, and he could make a joke. So he starts doing his map, and then he gets called out to do squadron commander business. So one of the guys cuts a big chunk out of his map and substitutes a different piece of the coastline into his map. And he was leading the formation, so we're all sitting back there going, "Yeah, when's he going to figure it out? You know that he's lost." So we get back down, and in dry humor fashion, he goes, "Okay, who glued the coastline onto my map?" And he was following it with his thumb. You know, you sort of track crawl with your thumb up the map, and he feels the ridge where he glued the piece onto the map. So he peels it off, and he goes, "Oh, you buggers!"
No way.
Yes, it was all good fun until they start shooting. Yeah.
Tell me a bit more about that before you sort of progress too far into your career. Tell me a little bit more about the process of getting fast jets. So I'm going to take you back sort of a couple of minutes to where you said you flew the T-33, then you decided you were going to go fast jet. You tracked fast jets, obviously. And there were three operational types, and sort of, you know, two of them weren't really an option. So it was a foregone conclusion which one you go to. At that point in time, were you thinking about the Hornet? You said it was nice that the Air Force had kind of forgotten you while they were bedding in the new Hornet. But were you thinking about that? Did you have your eyes set on it? Was flying fast jets more than you had expected it to be, better than you had expected it to be? Were there parts of it that were challenging? Were there parts of it you didn't particularly enjoy?
Yes to all of those questions.
Okay, there we go. We'll move on.
Yeah, no, but I'll address it a little bit because that's an excellent perspective. So, the really interesting part was about, I think it was about 2 months before our graduation, our wings graduation off the tutor. They would announce which airplanes were available for our course. You know, so they would say there was X number of Hercules, you know, Y number of whatever, and they said there's one fighter slot. And I can't remember how many were left on my course, because we split off the helicopter guys earlier, and we also had Dutch pilots on our course as well. So I'm thinking from the Canadians, there was probably about a dozen left, and there was only going to be one fighter slot. And I knew that I wasn't, you know, typically the top graduate of the course gets his choice, and then everyone else gets, you know, whatever they can fit for you. So I thought, well, okay, I'm not gonna get the fighter slot because I wasn't the top guy. But as it turns out, the top guy didn't want to go fighters, so they gave it to me. So I got it by default, and I was the only pilot off my course that got onto the fighters. So it was very, you know, it was very competitive to get onto the fighters. Now, what were your other
So, yeah, so
issues?
were there parts of it that you didn't enjoy? Was it a challenge? Or I guess the question I should ask was not a closed question, but how much of a challenge was it?
Yeah, so are you referring to the training part? or in general on fighters?
Yeah, so the training part, you know, to the point where you are flying the F-5, you were flying the Tutor. You described it as an old airplane. It's a bit like the T-37, isn't it? It's the Tweet, you know, the
It's, yeah.
Cessna T-37,
Yeah, yeah.
similar design, and I don't know, they may even be
Absolutely, yeah.
related. But
The Jet Provost.
yeah, so the Jet Provost, yeah. So
Yes, beautiful airplane that. Absolutely gorgeous lines. I'm saying that facetiously if you didn't know that. But anyway, yeah. So these are all, sort of straight wing, jet trainer aircraft. And then the F-5 was, it's actually an E category airplane. So the approach speed is so high on this thing that it's, I don't know if you're familiar with A, B, C, D, and E category airplanes. It's all based on the approach. On the approach speed, so E is the highest, and I don't think there are any, other than the F-5. There's a couple of civilian Mortal Fours that are still flying, but they're probably the only E category airplanes left flying in the Western Hemisphere. And then, of course, the Russians have theirs. But so anyway, the F-5, it was a fairly straightforward airplane to fly, and it didn't have any systems in it, so it wasn't like you were distracted. So, sorry to drift back and forth here. The F-18 was the opposite. The F-18 was extremely easy to fly under normal circumstances, but there were so many systems that needed to be operated by a single pilot. So we didn't have navigators. So we ran the radar, the weapon systems, the communications, the whole nine yards. So it was 180 degree switch. But the F-5 was a good lead-in for that because you had to be very careful what you were doing in the airplane, otherwise you could crash very quickly. And then the F-18, it led you into false sense of security. So, it had another thing, it had auto trim and auto flaps. So if you weren't careful and you didn't have the power up enough, you could go from 300 knots to 100 knots without even realizing it. And you look outside and the nose is all jacked up in the air from the angle of attack and you go, oh my God, what's going on here? Well, it's just, the flying characteristics are so benign in the F-18 that you could get yourself into trouble, with a false sense of security. So getting back to the F-5, when I was going through the F-5 transition course, which was almost a year, I guess. No, I guess it was about 9 months altogether. So it was fairly intense because they had to teach you to fly the F-5 and teach you how to be a fighter pilot at the same time. So during that time, we had an inordinate number of crashes in the fighter force, not just on the F-5, but also the 104 as well. And I'm starting to think, like, this is not good. Why are so many of these airplanes crashing with experienced pilots in them too? And there's, the primary reason was because of our low-level flying environment. It only takes 2 seconds if you're not paying attention and you're in the trees. So that was the primary reason for that, but it certainly got my attention. And there were two experienced instructors on the F-104. We still had the F-104 training squadron in Cold Lake because they weren't accepting new students to go on it, but they still had to recycle older guys. So they kept flying. They were still flying when I was there. And there were two very experienced instructors that went out on a dark and dirty afternoon, and they never came back. And it took them months to find their crash. They were flying around low level, and they hit a frozen lake, which is a standard thing to do in Cold Lake. And these were very experienced guys. They were second tour fighter pilots. So that's when the sort of doubt started creeping in. I'm thinking, and typically fighter pilots think that the first reaction to a crash is, oh, these guys screwed up. It's not going to be a mechanical thing. It's not going to be hitting a bird. The pilot screwed up. And that's our self-defense mechanism to say it could never happen to me because I'm the greatest fighter pilot in the world, right? So that's your defense mechanism. But then I started thinking, this is serious stuff. This isn't messing around. And we're not even at war yet, So the F-5, simple airplane to operate, relatively easy to fly. No equipment in it whatsoever, so no navigation gear, no radar warning receiver. We had one radio, one TACAM, one transponder, so it was a nightmare even operating it in civilian airspace because typically something would fail. So we typically flew around with two airplanes in close formation, and if one transponder wasn't working, the other guy would use his, and all that kind of stuff. But we had a lot of fun, you know. So we flew all over. The one of the best things that we did, we worked with a U.S. Navy reserve squadron, and they flew the F4S model, which is relatively unknown. And you know, when you can flash that picture up, I can talk about it a bit more. But the F4S, it's called the S because it's got leading edge maneuvering slats. So these were you could deploy them at high speed and use them at high speed, and they made the airplane much more maneuverable because the S model was designed almost entirely for air to air. So they could do air to ground, but they didn't do it. It was primarily a fleet defense aircraft. And when they cleaned that airplane off, you know, took the fuel tanks off, and we took our fuel tanks off in the F5, we could have great dogfights against them, and they loved it. These are mostly ex-Vietnam era pilots. They were airline pilots who flew the F4 on the weekends, and they just had a hoot, and we did too.
Let me try and find that picture, Bones. Just give us a
Yeah,
sec.
I'll keep on blathering on here
Okay.
while you're looking. So we used to go down to Yuma, Arizona, which is actually a Marine Corps air station, and we would fly out of Yuma and do air combat with these F4s, and then we would go out in the evening and eat nachos and drink beer and that kind of stuff. And then in the summer, they would come up to Cold Lake, so we would deploy from Bagotville back to Cold Lake. We had an air combat maneuvering range there. But the big attraction for them was the hunting. So they would come up and do hunting and fishing, you know, in the great wilderness of Cold Lake, which they couldn't do in San Diego, California. Yeah.
Okay, let me pull it up because a sec.
So what we're looking at here is a formation of four F5s, with one of them being plugged in, and the two U.S. Navy Reserve Squadron F4Ss. And the refueling airplane is a KA-3. I think the official designator was a Sky Warrior, but it was known as the Whale. And this airplane, it was a Cold War, like 1950s era nuclear bomber that they flew off the aircraft carrier, and it had no ejection seats in it. So they had like a sunroof that they used to open for the launch and for the recovery. And if they were going to go into the drink, they would unstrap and try and bail out through the sunroof. And I think they operated with a crew of three, if not four. So, you know, to think that they flew that airplane, which is the size of a small airliner, first of all, off the carrier, and secondly, without ejection seats, is just unbelievable. So we virtually had to do air refueling because our airplanes were stripped off. And the F5, it's carrying a electronic pod on the left wing tip, and it's nothing on the right. So those are normally used for Sidewinder missiles, but we typically flew with tip tank fuel tanks, and then either one external fuel tank or two, you know, under the wings. And the F4s, they're cleaned off as well, and they would typically fly with underwing fuel tanks as well. So when we took off the fuel tanks, we didn't have a lot of fuel to play with. So we would get airborne, get up to altitude, we would refuel off the A3, then we would go out and do our air combat, and then come back and recover. So the refueling was critical to get anything worthwhile out of the trip, because the F5s, we would have been up there for half an hour and had to come home. The F4s, those S models, a lot of them ended up in the RAF. So after the Falklands War was finished, the RAF sent their F4s down to the Falkland Islands for air defense, and they decided to backfill them with these U.S. Navy, U.S. Marine Corps F4Ss. So I think it was 74 Squadron that ended up picking up these ex-Navy F4s, and they operated them for, I don't know, maybe 5 or 7 years until the tornadoes started coming in.
I didn't know that. And I knew that they got
Yes.
J, the early ones they got were J models. I didn't know they got the S models as well. So
Yeah,
it's a good bit of history.
yeah, and they were, and the S might have been an unofficial designator. It was basically a J, but I think the difference was it had the, you know, the maneuvering slats. So instead of leading edge slats for approach and landing, you could actually use them at high speed and IG. Yeah.
Yeah. I think
I believe that's true.
They call that the soft wing, I think, don't they? They call it, there's the hard the hard wing, which is no, and then the soft wing, Bones, tell us a little bit about then, I wanted to go back and talk about the F5 in the close air support mode or the army support mode. I don't think you actually said close air support. I think you said it was to support the army, and maybe those are two different things. Yeah. But first of all, what were you going to put on the airplane? Bombs, rockets? How are you going to support the army in the airplane? I mean, you've already said it wasn't the right airplane for the role, but and that was a political thing. But how are you trying to do it?
Yeah. So getting back to the decision to buy them, in typical fashion, you know, there's because our armed forces were integrated. So Army, Navy, and Air Force were all considered the Canadian Armed Forces. And we're all supposed to be one big happy family and get along with each other. But of course, the reality is always different. So the Air Force wanted to increase their presence, despite the fact that we probably had 12 fighter squadrons back at the time. So they managed to convince the Army that the Army needed close air support. I don't think it was an Army initiative to say, hey, we need close air support. The Air Force said, you guys really need close air support, and we'd be happy to furnish that for you. But the Army said, yeah, sure. You know, like, we know what it is. You know, Vietnam had just finished, and it's important, you know. So the Air Force goes back to the national defense people and says, the Army says they want close air support, and we want to do it for them. So, you know, national defense says, yeah, sure. You know, take it out of your budget. No, not out of our budget. Ask them from the Army budget. So then the politicians got involved, and they actually looked at the A4 and the A7, which would have been great close. Well, that's really what their job was, is close air support. But they weren't willing to build them under license in Canada, and especially in Quebec, which has inordinate political influence in Canada. So they were built under license by Canadair, which became Bombardier later on in Cartierville, Quebec. And they also, they built them for the Netherlands Air Force as well. So the Dutch Air Force flew Canadian F-5s, but much better than the ones we had. They had a moving map, which was actually paper.
Oh, really?
And they had RWR and a couple other things. I think they had maneuvering flaps, whereas ours weren't maneuvering. But anyway, so, and we also sold them to Venezuela. Hmm. So there was a little bit of export business. But the idea was that our primary role was to support the Army. And we actually fell under the Army Aviation Group. So it was called the 10th Tactical Aviation Group, which was under the umbrella of the Army, not under the umbrella of the Air Force. So the initial guys would wear berets and stuff instead of their wedge caps. And we would all laugh at them. But they were very much Army oriented, despite the fact they couldn't really do anything. So we would do close air support, and we used the whole span of weapons, you know, general purpose bombs, 500 pound bombs, rockets. We had a Canadian developed rocket system called the CRB-7, and we flew with pods of 19 of those rockets. And I think back in the day, each pod was, I think it would cost about $75,000. So every time we fired one off, we'd say, there goes another Ferrari. It was great fun. You know, they were Mach 3 rockets, and they were quite accurate too. And we also dropped napalm. And that was a real surprise to me. So we had a firearms demonstration at the local Army base. And they said, okay, you guys are going to go in and drop napalm, and there's going to be a Chinese delegation as spectators. And I thought, well, you know, we wouldn't really employ napalm in combat. It got to the point where we sort of said, okay, we're not going to drop this anymore because of the, you know, the effects of it and stuff. They said, no, but it looks great. You know, just go ahead and do it. So we went in and dropped napalm. And napalm is amazing because when you drop a general purpose bomb, you know, high explosive bomb, it's fused so that it will not drop at too low an altitude, because if you drop it at 50 feet, it's going to blow you up as well as the bad guys. So typically it's about 100 feet is the minimum altitude. But napalm, because it didn't have that big of an explosive envelope, you could drop it at 30 feet. So we used to say, yeah, we'll just scrape it off on the top of the tank on the way by. So it was quite spectacular to drop it, but it's nasty stuff. So those were the primary ones. You know, general purpose bombs, rockets, and if we had to drop napalm. And so sorry to go off on a tangent here a bit, but the interesting thing is when you look at, we carry luggage pods on the airplanes, you know, if we're deploying or going cross country or whatever, and it's a, it's a canister with a door in it, and you can put all your luggage in there because there's nowhere to store it in the airplane. Well, they are all ex-napalm canisters that they cut a door into, so it's still actually a napalm canister.
They must have had a lot of them because everyone carries them, don't they?
Yeah.
I mean, the Americans
oh,
carry
yeah,
them and
they're,
just,
What
was the scenario, Bones, then, for in the air-to-ground side of things? Were you training for a scenario where the Soviets were coming over the polar ice cap, or were you training to deploy to West Germany to support a Cold War scenario there?
Yeah, no. So our primary role for NATO support was in northern Norway. So that was our sandbox where we were going to operate from. We didn't anticipate a over the pole landing of Soviet troops. So the air defense guys, the Voodoos at the time, they were responsible for the air defense, from the Soviet bombers. But we didn't anticipate a land invasion. And I mean, if they had have invaded the Arctic, you just leave them there for a month and they'd all be dead. So it's a very, very hostile environment up there, unless you're fully, fully supported. So, and, the Soviets are used to working in the Arctic as well. So they knew very well that there was no hope of a land invasion here. So that wasn't our job with the F-5. It was to go to northern Norway and to support the army wherever they were.
Can I ask you what that then in practical terms, what that looks like then? Because I don't think I've interviewed a lot of people about the sort of close air support mission in temperate climates, maybe in desert climates. So I don't think I've ever talked to anybody about it in sort of cold or Arctic type climates, where there's a lot of snow on the ground, there are lots of trees, where I guess an army force can hide. What did it mean in practical terms then? Were you flying along? Trying to strike things that, or were you expecting to be striking things out in the open? Were you expecting to strike things that had been, in revetments or were hiding in forests?
Yeah.
What were the practical expectations behind what that mission meant?
Yeah, so I'll just go a quick definition of close air support, and it is the key issue is close. So this is typically comes when an army unit is sort of pinned down. They don't have enough artillery support, and they run the risk of being overrun by superior enemy forces. So they'll call for close air support, and they will steer us on to the targets that they feel are threatening most. So back in the day, that would be based on visual observation on their part. Now we have satellite and all kinds of other reconnaissance assets. But back then, it was purely visual, and they would. As we're running in on the target, we would have a map of the area. They wouldn't tell us the coordinates of the target, but they would give us a talk onto the target. So they would say, reference the large lake, and we would say, contact. And they'd say, okay, southeast corner of the lake, peninsula land, contact. Okay, southern end of that peninsula, two groups of trees, one on the east, one on the left, one in the east, one on the west, and we'd say, contact. Or you'd say, no joy, and they try and describe something else. So they're doing this as you're running into the target at low level. And then when you feel that you've got the picture in your head based on what you're looking at on the map, you go, okay, I think it's probably in this area. Then you would pop up and they would call visual on you to say that they are seeing you. And then they would have to try and steer you onto the target while they're talking and saying, okay, my last thing was the two groups of trees, western group, southern end, concentration of forces. And you'd either say contact or no joy. And by that time, it's too late. They get to pull out. So it was boom, 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 boom. As soon as you got up into the pop, you had about 10 seconds to find the target. And when you called the target, they would have to give you clearance to fire because you're so close to the friendlies that if you're flying over the friendlies to get to the enemy position, there's a risk that your bombs are to fall into the friendlies. So it was very, very demanding flying. And that's why an airplane like the A-10 is good, because they can do it much more slowly. They're much more maneuverable at low speed. And they also have, they sit in a titanium cub, so they have reasonable protection from ground fire. But the F-5 and the OAC are really.
What were your expectations? And it's interesting to hear you say two things. Firstly, observing colleagues having accidents and dying, and sort of realizing that the whole flying business, well, fast jet flying business in particular, was not a laughing matter. It was a serious matter. But the other was to hear you say that it wasn't a very effective airplane for that mission. So what were your practical expectations if anything were to kick off? Were you expecting to be able to hit things on the ground while you were being shot at? Were you thinking this whole mission will be fairly futile? Were you thinking that far ahead in terms of how effective you would be as a warfighter if it happened for real?
Well, that's a very, I can only give you a very complex answer to that question. So we knew that A, that we would not be very survivable, and B, that if we did survive, it wouldn't be very effective. But, you know, it goes back to World War II. I mean, lots of guys knew that by storming that machine gun nest, their chances of survival were not very good, but that's what they had to do. So, and we did feel for the Army guys. I mean, if they're being pinned down by artillery fire and they got nowhere to go, then, you know, our chances are probably better than theirs are to attack the artillery that's pounding them. So you just got to do what you got to do. Amen. And that's not about heroism or any of that kind of stuff. That's about, you know, if we really are planning to survive this war, I don't give a damn about what the country's ideology is. I want to protect my brothers in arms that are on the ground, because like I said, our chances in the air are better than their chances on the ground. They got nowhere to go, you know. We can always, you know, if we start getting shot at and we can see the tracer fire, we can always turn around and get out of there, but they're stuck.
Yeah.
So I think that was kind of the underlying theme. And we didn't talk about that at the time, of course, because, you know, it gets back to that self-defense mechanism. You can't admit that there's a good chance you're not going to, you know, make it through this thing. So you think, okay, well, you know, I'm the best pilot out there, so I'm going to survive.
Can you expand a little bit on the low-level nav piece? I had a guy called Nick Forster on the channel. He flew Tornado GL4s and GL1s, and he talked a lot about low-level nav and flying the Hawk out of Valley Chivna in terms of sort of how they did it. I'd never heard anybody talk about tracking the route with their thumb. That's a new thing for me. It sounds obvious, but how did that work then? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so we used to, you know, sometimes you'd have quite a large map, you know, because we covered a lot of ground at 420 knots. So you'd have quite a large map, you know, which wasn't necessarily in straight out and straight back. It would go out in a big circle. So we would cut the map into strips, and then we would glue these strips together in a straight line. And then you would either, typically we wouldn't roll it up, we would fold it up into manageable size pieces. So it would be maybe, you know, 5 or 6 inches wide, and you would have to track where you were over the ground based on your time and your heading, and based on ground features. So typically, in order to keep track of where you should be on the map, you would sort of pull the map down with your thumb there. And that's how he found the piece that was glued on.
Okay. And so, so that, what sort of scale was the map? Sorry, I'm asking a really nerdy question. Because I'm thinking about lateral deviation. I'm thinking if you get bounced and you go left or right of the line, how far do you have to go before you're off the map?
Yeah, it was a nightmare. Yeah, I mean, it's all very good when you're flying on the line, on speed, on heading. But it's like you say, when you get bounced or you have to go around weather or whatever, then it starts to get real hard work. So because of the detail we needed, we actually flew with 1 to 250,000 scale maps. You know, typically VFR charts are 1 to 500,000.
Yeah.
But we flew with the 1 to 250, and you had good detail on the terrain features on those, but it made very big maps, of course. So, you know, it was an exercise in administrative management in the cockpit to try and not obscure your whole vision with this map.
There's a famous
patch. I don't know if you've seen it for the SR-71 guys, and they said, "You've never really been lost. You've been lost at Mach 3." So the faster you go, the farther off track you're going to be. Here. And I hate to admit it, but you know, like some people I knew got very, very far off the track and had no idea where they ended up.
What would you do if that happened? Just pop up and call air traffic, or get a TACAN reading because you were higher?
No. So that was, you know, the first tour I said I did in Bagotville, and we would typically go from, late October, probably late March, without having a ceiling above 1,000 feet. So
Really?
it was that part of the world where there was a lot of moisture in the air, and it was always low level clouds. So we would roar around, and we were cleared down to 100 feet then at 420 knots. So we would be roaring around at 100 feet. And like you said, if we got bounced or we had to deviate around a low cloud and weather and stuff, then you're off track. And now you're trying to get back on track to something that you can recognize. And if you don't recognize it, now you're in big trouble because you're not going to get an attack ant or any of that kind of stuff. So you could pop up above cloud and, talk back to base. But, even then, your radios are probably only going to work for about 100 nautical miles. So you really had to figure it out. You had to figure out how to get back to something that you recognized. And there were some big features out there, but sometimes that would get the pucker factor up for a while.
What about the terrain then? So you talked about how you sort of did your initial training in the flatlands, and then you start moved to more interesting terrain in sort of the central. Do you say Quebec? Is it Quebec?
Yes,
Yeah, central Quebec.
correct.
What? And I'm interested to hear you say that those two instructors in the 104 went and hit a lake, a frozen lake, and you said that's always the way it is. Are there sort of visual deceptions associated with flying over snow in the same way as there are
Oh,
flying
yeah.
low over the sea? What were the sort of visual
Similar, yeah.
and actual sort of physiological challenges behind flying low in the over that terrain?
Yeah, so this has happened a few times, and a good friend of mine was killed the same way too. He was flying over a frozen lake, and it can even be quite good weather. So people talk about whiteout. Whiteout is when you lose your horizon, but when you fly over a large frozen lake, you still have a horizon. But the problem is that the shoreline, you can confuse that with the horizon. So you'll now set your flight vector on the shoreline instead of the horizon, which means you're descending. So that's one of the possibilities. The other thing is, like flying over the ocean, you lose your perspective, and especially in high G turns. And you just can't visually gauge how high above the surface that you are. The rad alt works up to about 70 degrees of bank, but if you're beyond 70 degrees, it's not measuring in altitude either. So, and it's like I said, when you're at 100 feet and you're going those speeds, if you're not watching what you're doing, then 2 seconds later you get to the into the lake.
I noticed your aircraft in the picture that we popped up, a green, and obviously over a sort of foresty terrain where it's not snowy. I guess that makes them difficult to pick up. But was it snowy a lot, and therefore was it easier to maintain a sort of a visual formation because of the color? I'm curious to know whether or not green's a good color. With the RAF, for example, when they went to Norway, when they had green painted airplanes, they would paint them green and white. They would put this sort of temporary whitewash type thing on them, wouldn't they? And I'm sort of curious to know whether or not you did the same, and the effectiveness of the camouflage scheme that you had on those F5s.
And I'll tell you a great story in a couple of minutes here, but so there's no perfect camouflage, and the general consensus, as you can see now, in all air forces is a neutral gray. So you're absolutely right. If you're flying over a frozen lake or frozen terrain in a dark green airplane, then you're going to stick out like dog's bollocks. On the flip side, if you're flying a light airplane over the dark forest, you're going to stick out as well. So when I was flying the F5, we also used to do a red flag every year, which is great fun. It's down to Las Vegas, so we would stay in the city in a hotel in the city, and then we'd fly these missions, out of Nellis Air Force Base. And I think it was maybe the second time I'd been there. We deployed down there from Bagotville, and we spent the night in Williams Air Force Base in Phoenix, in Arizona, and then we flew from Phoenix up to Las Vegas, which is a fairly short hop. So the guy that was leading our formation of four, he'd been on exchange down in the States at Williams, so he knew the terrain. And he goes, "Okay," he says, "we're going to fly up the Grand Canyon," but he says, "you cannot go below the lip of the canyon." He said, "It's huge. It's not a safety issue, but it's highly monitored, and they've had a couple of mid-air collisions in there. So do not do that, whatever you do." So we go, "Okay, yeah, that makes sense." So we did that. A spectacular trip. We land in Nellis. And then a squadron of French Jaguars came in after us. And when they landed, there was a big greeting committee. So the base commander was there and a bunch of military policemen and stuff. We thought, oh, well, you know, I guess we don't rate that in terms of international welcome, but yeah, good for the French, you know. So we find out later that the French had flown into the canyon with their whole squadron of Jaguars, pissed off everybody, and they were getting a bollocking from the base commander when they landed. So getting back to the camouflage, they decided, you know, because they'd operated in North Africa and all that kind of stuff. So they thought they were going to paint their dark green Jags with this, you know, hodgepodge, desert colored camouflage. So the ground crew were out there and they did quite a nice job, actually. Like they'd, you know, we would typically just slop the paint on if we were going to do that. But they actually, you know, followed the contours of the green and painted over this desert camouflage, but it came out yellow. And it was, you know, back then, this was in the early 80s. So most of the air-to-air shots were visual heater shots, we call it, you know, the infrared missiles. And then you would call that out on the common frequency and said, you know, F4 over such and such, you know, Fox 2 kill type of thing. But whenever it was the French Jag, it would always be Fox 2 kill on the yellow Jag over this mountain. And you'd hear that over and over and over on the frequency. And it's like, oh man, you poor guys. So sometimes they screw it up, you know. Yeah. And we would do, they would take us out for a day if you wanted to do a desert survival out in Nellis. And back then we had tan flying suits or we had dark green flying suits. Those are the two choices that we had. So a buddy of mine goes up to do this one day survival exercise, and he took his tan flying suit, thinking that would be the best camouflage for him. So he finished at the end of the day, and they had a debriefing, and the staff that was doing the exercise said, "Hey, Canadian," and he said, "Did you realize how visible you were out there?" And he goes, "Yeah," he says, "I couldn't really find a lot of sand to hide in." So of course, all the rock out there is dark brown or even black rock, and that's where you're going to be hiding. You're not going to be out in the middle of the sand dunes, right? So he goes, "Yeah," he said, "You stuck out like a sore thumb."
Wow.
So camouflage is difficult. It's a hard one to call.
Speaking of survival,
You know?
winter survival, I guess particularly at the sort of latitude you're talking about flying, was there a serious threat of bears? It's one of the curiosities I have. If you were you did you always fly with a pistol, for example? So you know if you're
Yeah.
going to come down, you could shoot the bear.
Yeah, I wish you had asked me that before. I would have sent you off a cartoon that we came up with. But so we really started getting serious about flying in the Arctic with fighters with the F-18. And I guess I'm trying to think of the years. I guess that was in the mid 80s. The Russians were getting much more aggressive with their bear patrols over the Arctic and you know, probing our airspace. So they said, okay, we got to get serious about this. So they built a couple of temporary hangars at civilian airfields in the Canadian Arctic, and we would deploy up there and work out of those fields. And they said, okay, you know, we got to get serious about Arctic survival here in case something happens, you got to jump out. So the first thing was, you know, to get us a pistol, and they gave us this 1950s Browning 9mm Colt pistol, and we, you know, we always had to stay qualified on that, you know, whether it was going to Europe or to the Arctic. But it wasn't very good. You know, these things were well worn out. And at a 9mm, that's not going to penetrate a polar bear. So unless you hit him in the eye or something like that, you know, if you shoot into his chest, it's not even going to penetrate the fur, I don't think. Yeah. So we knew that that wasn't very good. So I'll try and get you the cartoon, and maybe you can patch it in later, but it's a hilarious cartoon. And there's a F-18 pilot standing there with a smoking pistol, and there's a polar bear looking at this hole in his chest, and the pistol is about, you know, it's like a handheld cannon, and it's the 50 caliber Bear Bopper Deluxe with depleted uranium rounds. Because we were all sitting there trying to go, well, what are we going to do? You know, this Browning 9mm is not going to do anything. So what kind of pistol are we going to get? And of course, all the gun guys are going, oh yeah, you know, you got to get a, you know, a 44 Magnum and all this kind of stuff. You know, so he said, okay, now I'm gonna end the argument here. It's the Bear Bopper Deluxe, you know. But the survival aspect, that was tricky too, because you know, even if they could get the assets out, to find you in the first place, you know, so assuming that the weather was good enough, because it was going to be a visual search for you, then they have to do something. So typically the search and rescue assets would carry a para jumpers, and they would parachute down and, you know, give you first aid and fire, shelter and food type of thing if they could find you. But then you had to get extracted, and because of the distances involved, it would take quite a while to get a helicopter up there to pull you out. So we knew it was going to be a huge challenge if you had to jump out of there. So we did do Arctic survival training, which was done in the high Arctic. You know, it wasn't just cold weather survival. This is Arctic survival, where you learn to build igloos and that sort of thing. But even then, you had to have some source of heat, and if you were injured, it was going to be very difficult. Yeah. So it was, yeah, it was a. And it's like flying out over the middle of the ocean. You know, as soon as you get out there, everything gets very quiet, and then you start hearing funny little noises in your airplane, and you go, oh. So if I can develop that story a bit more, is that okay?
Yeah.
Yeah. So when we deployed to Norway, we would fly with the Canadian tanker. It was a 707, civilian 707 that had been adapted for air refueling. And they would take four F-5s across at a time, and then they would fly back and then bring the next four over. So on one of the deployments, a good friend of mine, a guy named P.I. Weatherall, he was just pulling off the hose on the tanker, and one of his engines' compressor stalled. And, of course, that caused yaw, and then the other one compressor stalled. And get back to the ridiculous F-5. There was no auxiliary power. There was no ram air turbine. When you lost the engines, you lost all your AC power, and there were no DC powered systems other than a tiny little compass, a tiny little AI, and you had guard frequency on the radio. So he's going down through cloud with no engines, no instruments. He can't even talk to anybody. And he's going, if I eject, I'm definitely dead, because he's out over the North Atlantic Ocean. So I think he got down to about 10,000 feet, and he managed to get both engines fired up again. And he's climbing out, and his attitude indicator is tumbling, and he's going up through cloud, and he finally gets on top of cloud. He's 70 nautical miles behind the tanker at this point.
Wow.
So they finally doubled back and found them. And luckily, the tanker had its own TACAN station built into the airplane, so it could actually find you, you know, based on the tack end. So they were able to get paired back up, and he got his fuel and made it to Iceland. But yeah, it's just crazy, crazy stuff. Good.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like fun.
No. Yeah. Cause I mean, if you bail out or you're way too far from helicopter assets, unless you're close to the, you know, the Greenland or the Iceland shoreline, you know, where they have helicopters and that kind of stuff, but you're basically waiting for a ship to find you. Yeah.
Do you? I guess you don't really sort of dwell on any of this sort of stuff. You know the dangers that are ever present and that you potentially have to face on every sortie you fly. But what sort of coping mechanism or what sort of defensive mechanism do you develop then to make sure you don't end up dwelling on those things, that they don't constantly come back to your mind? Is there some discipline behind it, or is it just down to your personality? Oh, yeah.
No, it's discipline. So we're taught that we're all the best pilot in the Air Force, and we could never make a mistake and cause an accident. So yeah, that's facetious, obviously, but it was a slowly developed thing, I think, you know, and you get these realizations. Like when I was going through the F-5 training, I think we had about five crashes while I was going through the training, like fatal accidents.
Really?
And that's when you start thinking, well, what is it? You know, like, could they have all been that bad a pilot? Or, you know, none of them were mechanical failures. So you just have to rationalize it, basically. Yeah. And I think you get the gist of what I'm saying, but I'll tell you another interesting story. So, just after I got onto the F-18, my best friend in the Air Force, he was a bit younger than I was, so he wasn't as experienced as I. So, when we were both on the F-5 together, and then we both ended up on the same F-18 course in Cold Lake, but I ended up staying there as an instructor on the OCU on the training squadron. And he went to the operational squadron, which is next door to us in Cold Lake. And he was deployed out to Comox, which is on our west coast. And they have a QRA facility for air defense out of Comox. And there was a fishing boat that was in distress off the west coast of British Columbia in Canada. And they couldn't deploy the search and rescue assets because the surface winds were 70 knots, like surface winds 70 knots. So there was a bright spark in the Air Defense Headquarters that said, well, the F-18s can fly in anything. Let's launch them off. Maybe they can find this guy. So my best friend, a guy named Leif Erikson, he had been a fisherman on the West Coast, a commercial fisherman on the West Coast prior to joining the Air Force. So he was probably over-motivated, shall we say, to find this boat. And they flew over the last known position of the boat, and they couldn't. You know, it was noisy as hell with the winds and the storm and everything that's going through. And he wasn't sure if he was hearing this boat or not. So he thought, okay, well, I'll descend down below cloud and maybe I can see some lights. So he went off the coast out over the Pacific and descended down below cloud. But his moving map had drifted, and it was a known defect in his particular airplane. But his moving map had drifted, and he was not out over the ocean. He flew into a cliff at, at 300 knots.
Wow.
So, there's lots of lessons to be learned there. First of all, the defect, this was an acceptable defect to fly with, but it had enormous ramifications in this particular scenario. Would he have done that if he had not been a fisherman prior? No, probably not. That was, just by being out there was heroic enough on his part. He didn't need to get down beneath. And in typical fashion, the fisherman found a cove and he was fine. The rescue asset ends up dead. And this happens all the time, especially in Canada because the environment is so unforgiving. So yeah.
Wow.
It's a sad story, but there's lessons to be learned from it too.
Bones, tell me a little bit about the F5 and the air-to-air role there. You did mention, obviously, we flashed the picture up. You talked about going out and flying against those F4s and stripping everything off the jet, and it being a fun experience. So I've got two questions really around this. The first is that whenever I think of sort of fighter pilots, you kind of think of the sport of kings, air to air. Did you feel in your mind that you hadn't made it until you had sort of conquered that particular skill set? And the second is, did you conquer that skill set as an F5 driver, or did you have to wait till you were flying the Hornet before you really felt that you were that guy?
Oh yeah. Well, and flying air to air in the F5 was more fun than serious. So we knew that, the only way that you could really maneuver that airplane was when it was completely clean. So you couldn't do anything without the fuel tanks. Now you could jettison the fuel tanks, which we would do. If you got into a turning fight with the adversary, the first thing you do is jettison the fuel tanks. But realistically, no, we weren't going to do anything. But it was actually when I was flying the F5 with the Navy, and I got a backseat ride in the F4 one time. And so I saw it from his perspective, what he was doing, and it was quite surprising how he maneuvered the airplane. I didn't realize what they were doing at the time, so I was asking about it, and I said, "Well, why are you doing that?" Because typically, when you let's see if I can get both hands on you, typically when you come to emerge, you're turning towards the adversary as quickly as you can, trying to get on his tail. Well, when we came into emerge, he would dive the nose down with about 35 degrees of dive. And that means your velocity vector is off the adversary airplane. So I go, well, why are you doing that? You're not going to turn quick enough. And he goes, well, yeah, but it's about energy management too. So the only way to maintain your energy in these airplanes, because they didn't have 1-to-1 thrust ratio, is to take it down. And you had to do that without the other guy figuring it out, because as soon as he went down, now you're back in plane again. So if you're fighting the same airplane, that's you're just going around in circles. So that's how I learned to do that, and that was a very effective maneuver. Only if the other guy didn't realize what you were doing and match you doing it. But when I got onto the F-18, we had a U.S. Navy exchange officer on the squadron, so he'd flown the F-18 with the Navy, and then we had a couple of Canadian guys who were very, very sharp pilots. One of them off the F-5, and the other had come from the Voodoo, and they had done an exchange tour with the Navy and the Marine Corps, respectively, and then come back up to our Canadian training squadron as F-18 training pilots. And I would fly in the back seat with them, and it's like, holy cats! I didn't think you could do that in an airplane. But the F-18, it was just such a fabulous airplane. Like, you could do almost anything up to a Cobra maneuver and a tail flight in it. But it was so the flying characteristics were so incredible. So one of the things that I learned, and it took a long time to figure it out, we would, and especially if you're flying with another F-18, you get into these low speed vertical scissors where you're just, you're going straight up and you're trying to get the other guy to chicken out or fall out of airspeed and come down. Well, you're pretty well matched and both guys know how to do it, so you end up, you're both sort of following, and then you end up in this going down and doing the same thing on the way down. So you had to figure out some way to change the fight. And we would do a thing where you would actually, you got the nose all jacked up, probably 70 degrees in the air. You would actually kick the rudder and put into rudder aileron, which sounds like a sure way of getting into a spin, but it would actually pivot the nose around extremely rapidly. You'd usually get the yaw tone, just like beep, 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 saying your impending spin. And then as soon as you release the pressure on the stick and the rudder, it would keep on flying. And it was absolutely spectacular to see it, to see another airplane do that. And it looked like it was swapping ends. Yeah.
Wow.
So that was, if you're both going up and the other guy starts falling off and you're a little bit higher than him, you just kick the rudder and the aileron, and you're going to be right on his tail in a matter of seconds. Yeah. So that was one of the things that I learned on the F-18.
Tell us a little bit about when you got to the Hornet or how you concluded your time on the F5, because I think did you say you did two tours on the F5?
No, I did a long tour, so it was almost
Long.
5 years on the
Okay.
F5, and it, I was, so I was trying to get on the F-18 while I was on the F5, because I'd had a back seat ride on the F-18 fairly soon after we got it, so I realized there was a huge, capability gap between the two airplanes, so I really wanted to fly the Hornet, so I was pushing to get a Hornet tour from the F5. But an operational squadron, they're not on the training squadron. And then a good friend of mine from our squadron, he ended up on the Tornado GR1, the bomber. But he went from an F5 operational pilot to a Tornado instructor pilot. So he was on the OCU for the Tornado. And I kept in touch with him, and he said, "Hey, I'm having a great time," but he said, "It's really, really challenging here, learning the new airplane and being an instructor on it without ever having done anything like that, the terrain following radar and all that sort of thing." So I knew that that would have been a huge challenge. And then when I got onto the Hornet, a good friend of mine ended up on the exchange tour on the Tornado F3, and I knew him very well, so we kept in touch. And he said, yeah, he said, like the Tornado's got some significant limitations, but he said it's actually a great airplane. And he ended up in the first Gulf War on the F3. They were down in Saudi, I think. I think they were based out of
Oh,
Saudi.
yeah.
So he was telling me about that, and he said, yeah, he says, sure, I'd like to have an F-18, but he said it's got very good RWR. It had better RWR than the F-18 had. And it's a reasonably survivable aircraft and all that kind of stuff. So he wasn't averse to going into combat with the Tornado. So that gave me a better feeling, and then I ended up being selected for the Tornado F3 as well.
Tell us then about that transition to the Hornet from the F5. You've already described the fact that there are multiple systems. It's a proper platform for employing weapons from, rather than the F5 being at the opposite end of that spectrum. Did you, again, it's I'm trying not to ask too many leading questions, but did you end up feeling like you were back at the bottom of the heap again, because now you're having to work out how to run a radar, how to employ radar guided missiles? You know, you've got all of these things. What was the experience like?
Yeah, so that's a great question, because first of all, the airplane, you know, the F-18 was a long developmental process, you know. So it started out as the Northrop YF-17, and then when they decided the Navy wanted to buy it, they had to make it carrier capable. So that's when McDonnell Douglas got involved. And then when they designed the airplane, they designed it to replace the F-4, but with a single crew. So it was going to be single pilot, multi-role. They, you know, and I read a great book many years ago about the development of the F-18, and every single thing that they did was just so well thought out. Like even how they integrated the Vulcan cannon in the nose, you know, how they worked the radar around it. The big thing about the F-18 was the HOTAS, you know, the hands on throttling stick. So when you're pulling anything above 5G, I think it's virtually impossible to raise your hand and push a button on the instrument panel. You know, you just don't have enough strength to do that. So they knew that they had to put this on the throttle and stick. So there's you've probably seen the F-18. Well, you had a ride in it. Yeah. So, you know, there's like a mouse on the throttle, and then a cursor on the stick, and then all of the different weapons buttons and selection buttons. So you can go into battle without, you know, pressing anything on the instrument display. So it really is optimized for single pilot operations here. So getting back to your question, you know, when I'm coming from the F-5 with virtually nothing and going out to the F-18, the big advantage was that, you know, I was quite comfortable flying at low altitude. So then I could divert more of my attention to running the systems and flying formation, because you also have to keep track of your other airplanes with you too, right? So it's, you know, that in itself is very demanding. But because I'd had so much flying, you know, I had over 1,000 hours on the F-5.
Did you?
Mostly at low level. So then, you know, you build up a certain comfort flying at low level, and you know how much time you can divert to other tasks. Because it really is, you know, a time management thing. You know, how long can I afford to look down at the map and not look up at the mountain that I'm approaching? So,
yeah.
So, but there's no mountains in Cold Lake, so that wasn't a big issue. But you know, you know what I'm getting at. It's a time management thing. So the basic flying skills made operating the airplane significantly easier, and the airplane was easy to operate, but it was very, very complex. And then that's when you get into experience levels of pilots. So you know, when you graduate from the F-18 training squadron, you're pretty proficient at operating the airplane in the tactical roles, but then you need to graduate to be a two-plane lead, a four-plane lead, and then what we call a mission commander, which is mass attack, you know, multiple formations. And you know, there's no way to do that in the simulator. These are things that you have to go out and fly, you know, and do on a day-by-day basis to get that level of experience up, so that you can run your airplane, not hit the ground, see what your wingmen are doing, find the enemy, drop bombs, or shoot them with a missile.
Yeah.
And that's what you have to do. And there's, you know, there's just no substitute for experience. I mean, we had absolutely brilliant guys that at the end of their first operational tour would be fully qualified. You know, they could do anything, but they were sort of the minority of the system. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the talent pool then, before we sort of talk more about the Hornet itself. You've said right at the beginning you were the only guy on your course to get fast jets, and so competition was stiff. Small air forces tend to have sometimes a bit of an inferiority complex, don't they? I mean, you'll hear some air forces saying they might not have the best equipment, but they've got the best pilots, or they can do low level better than anybody else. What was the level of competition like within the squadron? What were the standards like? And did you compare yourself Well, presumably you did. How did you compare yourselves to the RAF, the US Air Force, the US Navy? Obviously, you guys are going out doing these exchange tours. You're coming back. You know what other air forces are capable of. Where did you rank yourselves? So what was the standard within the squadron?
Yeah, so I'll start with the squadron. Every time you go flying, there's a significant amount of preparation before you go flying, but then there's also a significant debriefing. And, you know, in the good old days or the bad old days, the first guy to the chalkboard would win the fight, you know. So he said, no, this is what happened. I thought you turned left. No, I turned right, and that's how I got on your tail. And it's like, oh, okay, this didn't seem right, you know. So there was a certain amount of BSing going on there. But once we got into the electronic range instrumentation, where you could actually see what every airplane was doing, and we had, you know, HUD tapes, so you could see what's going on inside the cockpit, basically, or, you know, the bravado fell very quickly to actual competence, and you could figure out who the good guys were and the not so strong pilots on the squadron. And that made it, you know, that's a very interesting question, because it made a huge difference in the typical fighter pilot. So we all think of fighter pilots, you know, as type A personalities that go around, you know, swaggering around and bragging about how great they are. And when you get onto the squadron, it is completely different. I mean, these are the most humble individuals that you will ever see, because even the best pilots make mistakes and they can't cover them up, you know? So yeah, you don't want to be blowing your own horn too hard, because they'll come down on you hard. And when I was on the training squadron, we had this guy who was, he was absolutely brilliant. He was a mathematician. He had the brain the size of a planet, but he was also tough as nails and huge ego. And he was quite a good pilot. So we're going out doing a night refueling training one day, and we're getting prepared to go. And I was on the next launch after him, but it was only about a 5-minute spacing. So we're getting prepared at the same time. And he had come from the F-104. They didn't do air refueling in the F-104. So he'd come on to the F-18 as an instructor, learn to do air refueling on the F-18, and now we're just going up to do some, you know, continuity training. And I'd come from the F-5, and we did air refueling all the time. So we're going on this night air refueling training trip, and he's going, you know, the guys are all razzing each other in the shoot room. He's going, yeah. He says, I never tip off. And tip off is when you hit the basket, but you don't connect, you know, so the basket goes like that. And the basket usually does this big gyration if you don't connect with it. So he goes, yeah. He says, I never tip off. And they go, okay. So he gets up there, he hits the basket, and he hit it bad. So when it let go, it went all the way around the nose of his airplane. It knocked off the AOA probe on the right-hand side. The AOA probe goes right down the intake, right into the fan. And the guy, I was on the next launch, I didn't see it, but the guys that came back, they were laughing. They said there was 40 feet of blue flame coming out of the front of the airplane and 60 feet out of the back. So he had to eat a huge piece of humble pie when he came back after that one. So, hey, Cash, how did it go? Like, you know, you never tip off. So there's no hiding. You know, you couldn't BS those kind of things here. So then getting back to international things, and that's a great question that I often get asked. And, you know, there's this misperception that exercises like Red Flag, or Maple Flag, and even courses like Top Gun are competitive. And, you know, for the fighter weapons course, there is a bit of competitiveness in there, because if you're the top graduate, you get an honor. But for the exercises, you know, Red Flag, Mid Flag, Cope Thunder, whatever you call it, the kills, the air-to-air kills are registered. The bomb hits versus misses are all registered. It's all electronically monitored. But they don't come up with a tally at the end, because quite often you get, you know, four or five countries participating, but they don't come up and say, yeah, Canada was the best, you know, US was number two, UK was number three. Now, there's nothing like that. But, you know, as you go through it, you can kind of see which countries are doing better than others, just based on an informal assessment from the debrief. So then you get back to pilots, and you say, well, you're from such a small Air Force, then surely you have a much bigger talent pool to draw from. Therefore, the fighter pilots who are, like I'm not making this up, but they are at the top heat, in terms of military pilots, right? So, we would expect that the Canadian pilots would be head and shoulders above everyone else, and that's not true at all, So, it's such a complex environment, and there's so many things involved. There are a few superstars that stand out in every Air Force that I've worked with, but to say that one Air Force is head and shoulders above the other, it's a hard thing to do. I mean, probably the USAF has the best training program and the best operational program, operational continuity program. So they tend to be very, very good pilots, but they have career issues too. So, they're on an up and out program. So after you've done one tour, you're looking at getting promoted to major. And as soon as you're a major, you're now in the career stream. So now you have to work on all your staff work too. And the RAF has professional aircrew status. So I don't know if they still have that. And that's really what you need. You need to say, do you really want to be an air commodore or do you want to be a fighter pilot? And that's the best system. Canada has sort of a hybrid system, so it's not recognized. There's no formal professional air crew, but if you're not pointing towards being a career officer, then they will keep you around for quite a while. And it's probably based on supply and demand. They just don't have enough experience to have pilots around. But that's a great segue. So when I left the Air Force, I left the Air Force in July of 2000. And I joined Air Canada, and Air Canada had a probation period when you first come to the airline. And at the end of that period, you have to write this 3-hour exam. So I had managed to get very good intel on what the questions were on the exam. I'm not saying I'm cheating. I just said I had very good intel. So I sat down and I'm going at tick, So after an hour of this 3-hour program, I'd finished. So I thought, oh, yeah, I can't really leave right now. I was the only guy in the exam room, but I thought I can't leave right now because it would be kind of obvious, So I'm thinking, okay, well, I'm going to go and get a coffee at least, and I'll just sit back here. And I didn't have a cell phone or anything with me, so I'll just look out the window. So I walked down the hallway in the ground school business building, and all of the staff were gathered into one of the debriefing rooms watching the TV. And I thought, what the heck is going on? So I look up and I see this airliner fly into a building in New York. I said, what's going on? And they said, well, this airliner just crashed into the World Trade Center. And while I was sitting there, the second one hit the second building. And I went, okay, it's not an accident now. My life just changed. Yeah. So that, going from the Air Force to the airline ended up being a significantly bad idea. So I knew that the airline was going to be drastically affected for probably several years. And eventually in 2003, Air Canada declared bankruptcy for various reasons, not just for 9/11. So I was going to be laid off. And I contacted the Air Force and I said, hey, are you interested in taking me back in? They said, oh, yeah, absolutely. So I said, okay, great. I'd really like to go to Bagotville on an operational Hornet squadron. I know they're really short on experienced pilots. I'm willing to do that. And he said, oh, no, we can't offer you that, old chap. No, you can go out and be an instructor at a Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, for a couple of years. And I said, no. So that's how pigheaded the Air Force was. They were short on pilots. They were stretched to the limit because they were on 24-hour alert duties because of the threat of more airliners coming over. And they were too pigheaded to take me back in as an experienced F-18 pilot. It was just, I thought, oh, you idiots. I don't know who's making these decisions, but they're anyway. But I eventually, after 9 years at Air Canada, things settled down, and I eventually ended up getting hired as a pilot on the Alpha Jet, and then we got to fly. In support of the Army and Navy and in the Air Force as well. And that was our primary job, really, was to do air combat training support with the F-18s. And the Alpha Jet was, it had nowhere near the performance or the technical abilities of the F-18, but all of the pilots were highly, highly experienced F-18 pilots. So as soon as we saw the F-18 pilot make a mistake, we knew what the mistake was, and we knew how to capitalize on it. So we could beat them in certain situations, in dogfights, I'm talking, not just in the big complex air battles.
How would you do it? So
And
we've jumped ahead a little bit, but let's talk about that then. So how would you, so the Alpha Jet would be familiar to most people listening to this, but that's a simple two-engined little fast jet trainer used by the Germans and the French,
very much like the Hawk.
like the Hawk. So how would you beat a Hornet in an Alpha Jet?
Well, it's like I said, you would see a mistake that they made. So if they got too slow, if they got too greedy and they tried to square the turn and they didn't get on your tail, then we would actually loosen off and get some airspeed back, and then we could actually outturn them because they were below their corner speed. So I don't know if you're familiar with the term corner speed. So that's the speed where you can pull the highest G. And typically that's the best place to fight the airplane. So when we saw them get down to like 200 knots, if they didn't dump the nose and get airspeed back right away, then we knew, okay, well, I've got you now. And it was that simple.
So
It would
kind
take a while to get back on the tail, but there was no escaping at that point.
let me just ask you about that then. So one of the things that people say about the Hornet, because it doesn't have an AOA limiter, is that it can threaten with nose pointing. It's got great nose authority, so you can effectively sort of sit it on its tail and still sort of move the nose around and point at people.
Correct.
If you're in your little Alpha Jet and he's only doing 200 knots, isn't that what he's going to do? Then he's just going to use the angle of attack capability that he has to just keep the nose pointed at you and just maybe get a tracking gunshot or a snapshot or something like that. Is that not how it works?
No. So this starts out when you're sort of across the circle, and our noses are nowhere near each other. And then he does a big bite, but it's not enough. Okay. So he hasn't got his nose on you. He can't put a weapon on you. And then as you come around, you realize that he's not accelerating again. So then we just manage our airspeed and eventually we'll end up on their tail. But this idea that you can just, point your nose everywhere, the F-22 can virtually do that, And now, of course, with the new missiles with the huge off-foresight capability, they can basically just look at you and launch a missile if you're within range. It doesn't matter where your nose is. But back in this day, you had to be within parameters to shoot the missile. It didn't have to be on the guy's tail. You even get your nose on him for a head-on aim-9 shot. But the trick is not to get into as the adversary to stay out of a position where he can get his nose on you within range to fire a shot.
So it's not this sort of silver bullet, this the nose pointing ability. It's something that still has to be selectively used and carefully managed, and
Yes,
not just going to
absolutely.
go to that every time because it's a
Correct.
okay.
So here's another funny one. I don't know if you've ever heard the expression with respect to the Harrier about vipping. Have you ever heard that?
Yeah, it's vectoring in forward flight.
So there's this great myth that if you came into a fight and you got fairly slow and somebody was coming on the Harrier's tail, that he would just pull the nozzles and viff away from you and then drop back into your six, a bit like the first Top Gun. Well, we used to fight the Harrier even in the Tornado, which is not a particularly maneuver airplane. And you go, oh, there he goes, he's viffing. Sorry, old chap, and you just go around the circle and then you gun him. And these are the Sea Harriers. They were the guys that was their primary role, was air to air. It wasn't the bomber Harrier guys. So it's like, oh no, that's not gonna work, old chap. Sorry.
Such wonderful irreverence. Tell us about then. Tell us about DACT against other types then. I mean, I just had on the channel a good friend of mine who flew the Eagle, and he talked a lot about how he'd fight the Tomcat or how he'd fight the F-16. And he talked about the F-16, being able to develop 30 degrees of nose of angles on him at each merge. And he said, at the second merge, if he wasn't doing that well, he would bug out. He would leave the fight. How would you fight an F-16? How would you fight an F-15 in the Hornet? What sort of approach would you take to both of those types?
So what the Eagle guy was getting at was the thrust to weight ratio. So the maneuverability of the two airplanes was quite close, as was the F-18. The F-18 was probably the lowest in terms of thrust to weight ratio and the highest in terms of maneuverability out of the three. But it gets back to the Alpha Jet fighting the F-18. So you had to really use that high angle attack capability very, very selectively. And the other thing we used to talk about is, you know, you could be out doing this 1v1 dogfight, you know, with the MiG-29 or whatever, and you're beating them and you're just about getting into position to shoot them. Well, you know, what about all his buddies out there? You know, when you're there in full afterburner at 70 knots, that's called being a flare, you know, so anybody could launch a heat-seeking missile at you and you got no maneuverability at that point. So we, you know, we love to talk about this, you know, high AOA maneuvering and all that kind of stuff, but it's really used as a last-ditch maneuver where you have no choice. You know, this is a knife fight in the phone booth, and it's either you or him. But it's the last thing you want to do if you have any other options. So getting back to your question, the F-14 is out of there. It's a bit like the Tornado. So it was designed as a fleet air defense interceptor, not a maneuvering fighter. Now, the later generations with the big GE engines, they were much, much better. But it's out of the picture. So the F-16, because it had this enormous thrust-to-weight ratio, it was the King Kong, really, of air combat. But the F-18 was close enough that we could force him into a high angle of attack regime, and they were limited to 25 degrees angle of attack. So it was hilarious. You know, if you take it up into a vertical scissors and they were, you know, they were accelerating like crazy because they had better thrust to weight, you go, okay, I'm just waiting. And then all of a sudden you'd see the nose falling off of the F-16 and you'd come up on the radio and they'd say, I see you're bowing to the superior aircraft, and you just pivot the nose on and gun them. And they knew that, and they go, oh no, he's going to do it again. But if you were in a classic two-circle fight, a high-energy fight, they would just march around the circle on you and shoot you with a heater.
Yeah.
And the same thing with the F-15, too.
So you...
The F-15 didn't have the AOA limit, but they didn't like to fly it at high AOA, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't as maneuverable as the F-18, so we could beat them too in a slow fight. But really, the advantage of the F-18 was the high AOA capability.
Yeah. Can you describe a little what it's like to fly the F-18 then in those regimes? You already talked about how you could go from 300 knots to 100 knots and not realize it. I'm asking layered questions, but it obviously has a full authority digital fly-by-wire control system. What does that mean to you as the pilot? What sort of cues is the airplane giving you that it's in different states of AOA? What's it like?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. So the full authority fly-by-wire system had built-in safeguards. So when you got to a certain AOA, and I can't remember what it was, you would lose the auto trim. So all of a sudden you're flying along slowly and you're going, why is the nose so high in the air? And then all of a sudden the stick comes forward and you're pulling back and you go, oh yeah, I'm only doing 120 knots. And it was the same thing when you're doing maneuvering. So, you know, when you're pulling at high AOA, it requires a significant force on the stick to keep the stick back because you're losing the auto trim. It says, no, you don't want auto trim right now. That's your worst enemy. So now you're into fully manual with protections, but you're basically flying a manual type airplane. So you would feel it. The other thing was when you got above about 20 to 25 degrees AOA, the airplane would start shuddering. And what was happening is it's the airflow coming off the leading edge extensions of the airplane. And you can see that they extend right up to the front of the cockpit, but the air curls around that and it hits the vertical stabilizers in the back. And on one of our, I think it was probably the first trip we did on the conversion course on the F-18, we would get into a high angle of attack situation. And the instructor would say in the back seat, he would say, okay, I have control. Now you look back at the tails. And you could turn around, you could see the tails because of the bubble canopy. And they were doing this. It was scary to see them.
Wow. Yeah.
So after about, I think we had them for about 3 or 4 years, they discovered some significant cracking in the tails and also in the longerons and the fuselage. So they actually grounded the fleet for, I think, about a year and put all kinds of reinforcements in. And they also put the what are called the Lex fences on the front edge of the leading edge extension. So it's these two blades that sit up on the Lex, and that detours the air. Yeah, you can see it
Just on
just
the
above your left
shoulder.
shoulder there.
Yeah.
That detours the air flow outboard of the vertical stems. Yeah. It
And
was scary to see. Like I flew it before they had the Lex fences in, and the tails are they're no kidding. They're doing this, and you're
wow.
going, ooh, that's probably not good. Yeah.
Did you have then seven, was it 7.33 G and then a 9 G override, something like that?
Yeah,
Could
yeah. So
you?
that's a great segue. So the airplane was limited to 7.5 G. And I think the initial models didn't have, yeah, they didn't have the G limiter, or they didn't have the override to it. I guess they didn't have the G limiter. No, I think they had the G limiter right from the beginning. Maybe they didn't have the override. So we had the paddle switch on the front of the stick, and you could override the 7.5 G limit, because normally, unless you really snatched on it quickly, it wouldn't go above 7.5 G. And another, it's another unfortunate story, and he was a friend of mine as well. He was on the course on the first F-18 operational squadron course. So this was the first course that they put through to generate an operational squadron, and they were going to be an air defense squadron in Canada. So they're out doing the intercept practices with the F-18 against the T-33, which was acting as a target. And it was a cloudy day. I don't know what the ceiling was, maybe 2,000 feet. So the T-33 was operating beneath the cloud, and the F-18 profile was to come slicing down through the cloud onto the tail of the T-33. And these guys had, maybe 20 hours on the F-18, and they were sending them out solo to do this. So the warning flag should have been going off all over the place that this is probably not the best way to do this. So he sliced down through the cloud. The T-33 pilot was looking for him over his shoulder because he knew that he was coming down, and he watched him hit the ground. So they had a pretty good idea what happened. Well, I don't know if it was before or after, but within a space of probably 30 minutes, another solo pilot had done the same thing, and I think he pulled 11 and a half G and missed the ground.
Wow.
So, yeah. So I don't know. I can't remember whether the paddle switch was there or it had different limitations before or after. But the other pilot was the guy that was very fortunate that he didn't end up in the same position. Yeah. It's crazy things. Like, why were they doing that in the first place? And especially with a solo student, at least put an instructor in the back seat, because we had all kinds of two-seat airplanes. It wasn't like we were short of airplanes, but put an instructor in the back seat, because we know this is potentially a very dangerous profile.
It raises in my mind a question about how you sort of operationalize, let's say, a new weapon system like the F-18. You're coming from F-101s, F-5s, sort of older generation, sort of what are they, second generation fighters to a new third generation, fourth generation fighter. Are you sort of then in the Canadian Air Force, are you having to develop all this stuff yourself from scratch? Is this a symptom of the fact that you're doing that, or are you bringing in US Navy tactics and then saying, are they giving you their tactics and you're saying, well, okay, well, because it's a long range radar. You've now got the AIM-7 Sparrow, and then the AIM-120 is going to come along at some point in the future. How much of it do you have to make up yourselves? How much of it do you take from other places and then just modify?
Yeah, so when the F-18s were delivered, McDonnell Douglas at the time, they provided us with the technical manuals for the airplane. And the U.S. Navy provided us with the tactical tac manuals to employ the airplane, and plus we had Canadian pilots on exchange with Navy and Marine Corps F-18 squadrons prior to us having them delivered in Canada. So we had a and the initial cadre of instructors on the training squadron, they had been going down to the States to Navy bases, flying the simulators and all that kind of stuff. And, coordinating with them. So that's the great thing about NATO and NORAD. We do have a very good relationship with our allies, and they're willing to share, huge, huge amounts of information with us because we're allies, right? So they want to see us succeed just as well. So we had a very good start. But now you're integrating the Voodoo pilots. So this is in the instructor cadre. You're integrating the Voodoo pilots, the F-104 pilots. So on one hand, you got air defense, who do a little bit of air combat, but no bombing. On the other side, you've got bomber-only pilots who never really done any air-to-air work. And then you got the F-5 pilots who do everything but nothing well, the jack-of-all-trades. And then you've got a couple of guys who are coming off the Hornet down in the States, and they're going, no, no, guys, you can't do it this way. You know, like, I know how that you're interpreting what the Navy is saying, but that's not how it works, you know? And here's a classic example. I mean, you know, the F-18, the one that we have is the Navy version, right? It's the carrier capable. It's not the YF-17, which was the, you know, what do they call it? The Cobra or something, which is the land version. And so, you know, Canada gets the F-18. They go, okay, well, it's, you know, the flight controls are integrated with the landing system. So the flight control laws change once you get the weight on wheel switches. They go, okay, we have to do carrier landings on airfields so we make sure the weight on wheel switch is activated. So the flight control laws change. And it's, you know, like that in itself has caused a couple of crashes because if you have a big crosswind, you know, the typical pilot will put into wind aileron and opposite rudder to keep it straight, right? And then if you, when you land, typically the into wind wing will lift, you know, so it'll come up. Well, if you jam the aileron into that, the rudder will go that way as well. And then you go off the side of the runway. And that's happened many times in the F-18.
Wow.
So you have to be careful with it. You know, this is, it's there to protect you, but it can kill you just as quickly.
Wow.
So getting back to my story, the Canadians said, okay, well, we got to do carrier landings. You know, every landing's got to be a carrier landing. You can't do greasers because you're not going to make that weight on wheel switch. So we had a U.S. Navy exchange pilot who come off the, you know, off the Navy Hornet, and he's now an instructor with us on the F-18. And he goes, why do you guys slam the airplane into the runway all the time? And we go, well, you have to get the weight on wheel switches. He goes, no, 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 no. So when you land the airplane, the throttles are stopped at flight idle instead of ground idle. And then as soon as you make the weight on wheel switch, you can pull the throttles back to ground idle. So he goes, just keep your hands on the throttle, do the lightest landing that you can possibly imagine, and then see if the ground stops come off. And the F-18 actually had a G meter for measuring the landing G. And that was so that, you know, if you really slammed it on the carrier, they could decide whether they needed to inspect the airplane or just send it back up flying. And I don't know what the G limit was. So we used to have competitions to see who could get the lowest G on landing. And it would, the recording would stay up for the next pilot. So you go in and you go to the data page, you go, oh, damn, he got a 0.1. It's like, oh, so with a 0.5, a 0.05, you know. Yeah, but most of the guys wouldn't believe that. You know, they were still doing carrier landings, you know, 20 years later. And it causes a huge problem. We had, a couple of runway excursions because guys would, you know, they would do these carrier landings, especially in big crosswinds, and the airplane would get extremely unstable because it has these big floaty landing gear and all the flight controls that are trying to figure out what you really want to do as to what they want to do to protect the airplane. And they would depart the runway. And I watched one of them, you know, I was right behind him and it was spectacular. He went off into the grass at 140 knots. And it was like, my God.
Did he punch out?
So, no.
Stay with the airplane. That's good. Wow.
Yeah, and the first thing it's boldface. It says if you depart the runway in an uncontrolled situation, eject. You know, not maybe consider eject. It was an order to eject. So I see him go off the runway, and there was dirt and mud spraying. You know, probably 40 feet in the air, and I go, he's not ejecting. He's not ejecting. You know, so I expected to see the airplane tumble into a big ball of flames, but the infield was absolutely saturated, and it was quite soft. So he just went zinging off the side of the runway, and he said it was quite smooth. So he said, okay, well, I'm going to stay with it. So he eventually comes to a stop in the infield, and the emergency egress is either open the canopy with the electric switch, which takes, 15 seconds, or jettison it. So he pulls the jettison handle to get rid of it, and the jettison handle didn't work. There was a problem with the explosive charge
Wow.
in the jettison. Now, he could have ejected through the canopy with the seat, but that's not ideal. So he did the ground egress, and by the time I was behind him, and by the time I did the overshoot, I could see him hoofing it across the infield. It's like, okay, he's okay.
Wow. Did
Maybe.
that result in so did that result in a change then in terms of landing technique? Did this, I mean, is this decentralized? Does the squadron boss decide what you use? Do you
No.
decide it as individual pilots? Does the Canadian Air Force decide
No.
it? What?
Yeah, so it's driven by the oversight, the sort of tactical oversight of the F-18 fleet. I had previous, so this was on the operational squadron, but I had previously been an instructor pilot. So I spoke with the guy that went off the side of the runway, and I said, "Well, tell me what happened." And he explained what he did, and I said, "So are they still, this was after I'd finished two tours from the training squadron. So I'd been out of the loop for probably 6 years at that point. So I said, "Are they still teaching that on 410, in the training squadron, that you should do firm landings?" He goes, "Oh yeah, absolutely." Yeah. So we had the accident review board, and I went in to talk to the investigator, and I said, "We can't keep doing this. Like, this is crazy. There is no reason to do hard landings in the F-18." And I explained it to him. They said, "I'm not making this up. Like, I was an instructor on the F-18." And the system wouldn't believe us, because somewhere 15 years ago, it was written that you should do hard, firm landings so that you activate the weigh-on-wheel switch.
Wow.
But guys would bounce, and then the airplane's doing this as it's bouncing, going from one mushy landing gear to the other mushy landing gear. And now the flight controls are all over the world,
Yeah.
so you're now along for the ride, basically. You're out of the loop.
Wow.
It was crazy stuff.
Thanks for tuning in to 10% True. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Feel free to subscribe, and if you're on YouTube, hit the bell button to make sure you get notified of the next episode. Thanks and take care.